If you lived in Nashville in the 1990s and loved live music, you may have known about the punk scene at Lucy's, but you definitely knew about the resurgence of hillbilly and western swing on Lower Broad. The music played at the rundown honky-tonks couldn't be more different than the music at Lucy's, but the DIY ethic was the same. Find a stage that was willing to have you and put on a show. Put on a lot of shows. One guy who was equally at home in both places was Smilin' Jay McDowell, a guitar player turned upright bassist from the small town of West Lafayette, Indiana. Jay was encouraged to move to Nashville in 1992 by a friend, a guardian angel really, who knew that once Jay got here, he'd be successful. Jay wasn't as sure, but then he started going to Lucy's, playing kickball at Dragon Park, and meeting other musicians who loved rockabilly and swing music as much as he did. When did you pick up an instrument at first, and what was it?
Guitar, probably. I was about five.
Did somebody give it to you, or did you ask for it?
My father was a player and still is, and so it was around, and uncles, and the instruments were always around, yeah. So. And then I wanted a drum set, and then I played saxophone in the school band. And so very musical from the get-go, always searching and wanting to hear new music.
Yeah. Do you remember the first album you bought?
Oh, gosh. With my own money, it would have been The Village People.
Nice.
And, yeah.
Very popular.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Reaching middle America. But what's fun, in hindsight, again, that's impressive that broke through the mainstream in that time and place. But
well, they were just dressed up in costumes.
That's the way I
saw what village? It. And it could have been any village.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then, so just always trying to discover new music. And I guess through my parents was exposed to everything. They were great about exposing me to different types of music. They would play music around the house, obviously, to listen to for themselves. But I remember them making a point of like, here, Jay, listen to this. This is reggae. This is jazz.
Wow.
This is, you know, things that in hindsight, again, I'm looking back at that like they just wanted to kind of expand my mind. And I try to do the same to my kids now.
What was the first band that you played in?
We were called Catch 22. And yeah, we played locally around Northern Indiana. And now where I grew up, I was always looking for other musicians that were into different types of music, and you find them, but moving to Nashville, that was oh my gosh, there are so many people here that are into different types of music, and so many people that are into exactly the kind of music I'm into, so that was this awakening as well.
Yeah, what brought you to Nashville?
So I had a friend growing up that was an audio engineer, worked for the CBS station in West Lafayette that happened to be on my street, and we hung out and played music together, and he was my biggest champion. He would always brag on me, and, you know, when I'm a teenager, and he was a couple years older than me, and he would get me gigs and get me, you know, he would talk me up when I was too shy to say anything. And
How good you were.
Yeah. He would champion me. Oh. And he got a job at WSMV as the audio engineer here at Channel 4 in Nashville. So he moved to Nashville, and I was kind of crushed by that. He was, you know, leaving town. So he moved down here, and when he would come back and visit me, he would say, you have to move to Nashville. You've got, you know. So he kind of opened the door for me to come here, and his encouragement. So the band I was with at the time, we all moved down here, the Shindigs. So again, John Van Etten, the audio engineer, was talking me up and helped, you know, he wanted me to get gigs. And I'm coming to Nashville thinking, well, you know, everybody here plays, you know, I'm a guitar player, that I'm nothing special. And he would talk me up and introduced me to people and gave me confidence as well. And so then I started meeting up with other musicians. And as you live here in Nashville, you realize there's all these people coming from other parts of the country for the same reason. And you start finding those people.
Your people.
And I started finding my people, mm-hmm. and people that loved rockabilly music and swing, and that wasn't plentiful where I grew up. But yeah. I came to Nashville, and I found out it was. So something I didn't see coming in the moment was when I moved to Nashville, my roommate, John Delworth, got a job at Tower Records. Through that, we started meeting other musicians and other people that worked at Tower. Well, we started going to play kickball in Dragon Park on Sundays. And the people that I was just going to play kickball and have a little fun. We'd sneak beer. We'd play some kickball. We'd end up at somebody's house playing music. And I didn't think of it that way in the moment, but I realized looking back on it, I was meeting all these local musicians, people that I didn't know were musicians, but it's Nashville. Of course, they were musicians. So looking back on that, I realized like, oh, I made all these connections through that that served me in the future musically.
Who did you start playing with first here? On a regular basis where you were gigging and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. So I met up with these guys from Murfreesboro, and they were complaining that their guitar player had not shown up for a few practices in a row. And I remember standing there saying, well, then you don't have a guitar player. Like you know, I understand missing a practice, but... And we get talking, and I said, when's your next practice? And they said, well, Thursday. And they said, but he's going to be there. And I said, well, I'll bring my stuff just in case. And if he is there, we'll just jam together. And I remember they were just kind of like, okay. Yeah. So, and I went knowing the guy wasn't going to be there. Yeah. Like if he's missed two or three or four practices. So yeah. I went down to Murfreesboro. They had a storage space they rented that they rehearsed in. Plugged in and we started jamming, and it was great. And they were doing original rockabilly stuff, and I was in heaven. I just fit right in. It was great. And we were called Hellbilly. They had picked the name already. And we got a gig at the Borough, and we played with this band called the Fun Girls from Mount Pilot. And just hit it off with them. And now when I moved to Nashville, I moved to Nashville in August 1st, 1992.
Whoa,
that's
really?
That's when I got here.
That was literally 2 weeks before Lucy's opened.
Exactly. So when I got here as a record collector and exploring Nashville, a new city, I'm just moved here. One of the very first things I did was get the Yellow Pages and go to every record store. You know, you go to Great Escape and Phonolux. And I remember going to a record store on Charlotte, and I walked in and didn't really seem like a record store. And I asked the guy working there, are you a record store? And he kind of goes, well, kind of. And they were selling smoking apparatus, and they had a little box of some 12-inch singles in the corner. He's like, well, yeah, there's our records. But then I kind of realized like, oh, this is a front for something else. But I remember going into your place and it being very small, meaning there wasn't a lot of stuff for sale, but I could see exactly what it was, what you had for sale. I could see where it was coming from. Yeah. I was like, oh, this scratches an itch that other places don't scratch. And, you know, so I loved that. So to kind of bring it back, meet Fun Girls from Mount Pilot, Donnie is telling me that he's booking, he was trying to bring bands to Lucy's. And so that's how we got playing there. And what I loved, all ages to me, same as it was in Indiana, as it was in Nashville, meant it just was all inclusive. Mm-hmm. That's all that meant to me. I wasn't worried about, is there alcohol, is there not alcohol, but it was a place to play, and that meant that it was a place for everybody. Mm-hmm. So that was the importance to me, and obviously to the community, that's what's important. But if you were the most traditional country band, you could get up there and play at Lucy's. And people, you know, some people might snicker or whatever, but nobody was going to stop you. You could be as avant-garde and out there as we could even imagine, and you had a stage, and nobody was going to stop you from doing that. And that's what makes the world go round. That's the beauty of it.
Do you have a favorite show that you saw at Lucy's that was not Hellbilly?
Well, two come to mind. One was this band called BR549, who I would eventually go on to be in, but this was before I was in them, and they were just playing for tips downtown on Broadway. And this was going to be the first time I was going to see them perform outside of that realm.
So you were seeing them. You were going downtown to Lower Broad at the time. Okay.
Yes. A whole parallel universe to Lucy's.
Yeah.
So BR549 gets this gig at Lucy's, and I'm excited for that, just to see them in a different setting, and because I was so familiar and comfortable with Lucy's. I'm encouraging those guys, like, yeah, it's going to be great, you know, and they're like, I don't know if, we're not that kind of music. Again, a very traditional country band, but with this kind of, it's hard to put into words, but a punk approach to that kind of music, if that makes sense. It wasn't punk music in the sense of punk music, but their approach to how they did things and how they went about it was DIY and let's put on a show, and we're playing for tips.
We're not going to wait for anyone to give us permission to do it.
Yeah,
we're just going to do it.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
So they were set to play Lucy's, I think, at 10 o'clock, and they showed up for sound check, and I just went there to hang out with them just because they're my buddies. Yeah. And when they got there and loaded in, Donnie was saying, "Well, you guys are going on at 7. Not 10. And they're like, "Well, no, we've told all our friends that we're going on at 10 and nobody's going to be here at 7. And Donnie's like, sorry, but that's the way it is. So they canceled their night playing downtown. It was their livelihood of making tips downtown to play this show. And
oh no.
In the audience was like me and 3 other people. Well, that night, they kind of had the night off. They did their little show, their little set at Lucy's, which they were used to playing for 6 or 7 hours. So to them, that was just like, okay, we did 45 minutes. And then we all went out to eat, and it was a blast. And I just remember hanging out with them and, having a good time. But when you ask about favorite shows, Low Straitjackets comes to mind. Surf band from Nashville. And through Deanna Verragona, I had met Danny Amos, who was a guitar player, and he'd been in a surf band called the Ray Beats from Minneapolis. And I had some Ray Beats records, and I was familiar with them. And so we meet up, and I remember going out to eat at some Mexican restaurant with Danny. And we're hanging out, and he's telling me this whole concept about this band he wants to do. It's all instrumental. We're going to wear Mexican wrestling masks. We're going to speak in Spanish. Like, he had the whole concept, and he's telling me over dinner, and I'm just thinking, like, well, you go, you do you, man. I couldn't see it, but okay. So they played at Lucy's, and I saw it. It was incredible. So the drummer was set up front and center on a riser. The band stood around him. They had choreography, again, in masks. Danny would speak in broken Spanish between every song. I don't speak Spanish, so I don't know how good his Spanish was. But that was a show also. Like, they put it on. It was rehearsed and blew the room away, and it was packed. And that's a special memory to me of how good. So Eddie Angel and Danny Amos and Scott Esbeck and Jimmy Lester, those guys were all on it from the beginning. And then, they put records out and traveled, and they're still going, to some capacity, they're still going strong.
And I have visions. Scars are in the sky. Holy water is running from your eye. And all our trouble cannot be gone too soon. A cowboy on the moon.
Seeing Lamb Chop at Lucy's was also a favorite memory. It was like the entire band was playing as little as possible. It was minimal, and it was restraint. And it made me uncomfortable because I just wanted them to let it out. Let it out. Let it out. Here's another song, and it's very minimal. And tension builds up from that. And I'm watching it, and it's bothering me. And then at the end of the show, they let it all out. And it was such a release. And that was like an art, that was artistic in itself. It was a delivery that was artistic. Well, the second time I see them, I go into it with that knowledge. And that's a slightly different lineup, but the same kind of approach. Now, I've talked to John Dilworth about this since. And John was like, oh, I never even thought about it like that. He said, I was just trying to serve the song, and yeah, there wasn't always keyboard parts. And, you know, but I'm watching the crowd the second time, aware of my anxiety the first time I saw it. And I'm watching the crowd. Now, some of them, it's going right past them. They're not tuned in enough to even be bothered by it. But I'm watching the other people that are kind of fidgeting, and I'm enjoying the thing that's happening, the outcome of the performance, that the crowd is uncomfortable. And there's people I can see are uncomfortable and they don't know why. There's people I'm thinking maybe he's in on it and he knows why he's uncomfortable. You know, like he's processing it like I was. And then I'm entertained by that just as much as I am by the music. Now, as I see the shows over time, when they do blow it out at the end, because inevitably they blow it out at the end, sometimes it's glorious and it's a release and it's amazing. And other times it's just a mess and it's loud and it's noisy and it's not, you know, there's times when it works and there's times when it doesn't. And that's something you can't really present on an album. And I love Lamb Chop albums, and they're different. Each one is different. But the joy that I got from that band was the live experience and going through that. And so that was important to me. And then becoming friends with, I always felt, again, like I felt like I was in the band Lamb Chop. I never once performed with them on stage, but I felt welcomed and like I could hang with them. And there were so many people involved that it was a rotating cast kind of thing. But I always felt part of that.
In a lot of cities, there's a major street named Broadway. The Broadway in Nashville starts downtown at the mighty Cumberland River and runs southwest for about 2 miles until it ends at one corner of the sprawling Vanderbilt University campus. There's a ton of history on Broadway in Nashville since it was one of the first roads in the city, but its most famous section is Lower Broad, the area that runs downtown from the river at First Avenue and up 4 blocks to Fifth. To give you an idea of just how famous, the Ryman Auditorium, which is home to the original Grand Ole Opry, sits between 4th and 5th, one street over, and shares an alley with two of the most famous of honky-tonks on Lower Broad, Tootsie's and Roberts. The stories of Grand Ole Opry stars sneaking across the alley into the back of Tootsie's to party to excess are legendary. When the Grand Ole Opry left the Ryman Auditorium in 1974, much of the legit nightlife that had been building since the 30s left Lower Broad as well, and the historic buildings became the rundown home to a bunch of pawn shops and peep shows and cheap souvenirs. The revitalization of Lower Broad began in the late 80s. Some of the buildings were big and beautiful and were attractive to artistic types looking for cool, cheap places to build out their lofts, and investors who had been tipped off by city leaders that the area was about to get a major investment. Live music on Lower Broad got a major boost in the early to mid-1990s when a bunch of transplanted country music playing traditionalists wrangled their way onto the stages of the original honky-tonks they had read about and loved from afar. One of the biggest bands to come out of that era was BR549. Smilin' J wasn't a member of BR when they first started playing at Roberts, but when he became one, switching his primary instrument from guitar to upright bass to fulfill a vision, he added one more detail to their substance and their style.
Remember when we hung in the low places in 1979? We used to think that it mattered to the man. Chain around her neck, oh, but you never recognize her. If you saw her now, she does something that you never expect. She done traded in the docks for kicker boots, safety pin t-shirts for man wears suits. Her hair's grown out and it's piled up high. She only shows her tattoos one at a time. She ain't ashamed of the way she was. She hears old Hank, she can't get enough. Her funk rock records are gathering dust.
But this part of Jay's story starts in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, 35 miles south of Lower Broad and the geographic center of the state, at a magical place called The Burrow.
So the origin of that is that very first show at the Borough with Hellbilly. I'm playing with Hellbilly the night we played with Fun Girls of Mount Pilot. There's a guy in the audience with his girlfriend, and I met him after the show, and I remember sitting there having a beer with him, and him and his girlfriend, and we're talking about music, and he'd just moved here from Lawrence, Kansas, and we hit it off, and we exchanged phone numbers, and years later, his girlfriend, who's now his wife, she said that very first night when we were all sitting around the table, when they were driving back to Nashville, she said, "You should be in a band with that guy," speaking about me.
Yeah.
So I called Chuck a few days later, and he said, "Yeah, I'm going on the road with my drummer." They had a two-piece, and they were going to be gone for like 12 days. And so he's like, "When I get back in town, let's hang out." So we got together, and we listened to some records and played some guitar, hit it off, and just a super cool guy. And his name is Chuck Mead. And at the time, he said, "I just got a job. I'm a doorman at Tootsie's." And he said, "You got to come down there. It's amazing." Now, I'd been down to Lower Broadway and was turned off. It was not inviting. I wanted it to be exciting and happening. And it was run down and hookers and peep shows and adult bookstores. And the music down there was sad. It was songwriters trying to get their songs heard. It wasn't bands. It wasn't polished. It was just dirty, and I didn't feel comfortable there. So when he told me he was working down there and how great it was, I was like, "Oh, well, okay." Yeah. So I went down there, and I walked into Tootsie's. There's three people in the bar, including the bartender. And Zach Taylor was playing guitar and singing. And Chuck's the bouncer. Now, Chuck's built like I was then, skinny and nothing to him, you know, and not a tough guy at all. But he was just, you know, kind of there to keep the peace and keep people from getting into fights and stuff. And, Zach took a break and set his guitar down, and Chuck said, "Hey, can I play a song?" And sure. So he got up and he played Dixie Fried by Carl Perkins. And that's when I saw Chuck play by, you know, like I said, we'd sit around and picked guitars a little bit, but
yeah.
When I saw him get up in front of on a stage and play, I was like, "Oh yeah, this guy's got it." So then he said, he finished his song, and he gets back down, and Zach starts playing again. And Chuck said, "Oh, have you seen the back?" I said, "No." He said, "Follow me." And we walk up out the back door of Tootsie's, and he opens the back door. Now, the back room of Tootsie's back then was dilapidated, and there was no roof. It was a partial wall, and it was fallen down. But when he opened that door, the Ryman was like, the lighted Ryman wall was right there. And it was this, you know, I heard music that kind of, "Oh wow," you know, and he's like, "Isn't this amazing?" You know, like all the ghosts back here. So I kind of saw Lower Broad through Chuck's eyes that night, and it made me realize that his point was like, this place is wide open, man. We can do whatever we want musically down here. And so I kept up with him, and then me and my friends would start going down there to drink and hanging out. And again, it was seedy and dirty, and there was a very small clientele, but one by one, these younger people started showing up, and I started noticing hipsters and college kids. And I think a big part of it was they weren't very strict about IDs, so college kids could show up and drink. Later, as I was playing down there regularly, when I started seeing people I recognized from Lucy's, I started realizing, oh, this is a scene. It's happening. They're mixing in with the truck drivers and the old ladies and the hookers, and you know, it's this big community. So Chuck was working at Tootsie's. He meets up with a guy named Gary Bennett, who was down there, just moved in from Washington State. They find out that they know all these Johnny Horton songs and have all this music in common. They start performing together. What you do on Lower Broadway back then is you have a shift, a four-hour shift, and you play, and it was typically one person, and you play for tips. And they would be working at one of those clubs down there for 4 hours, and then the other guy would be working after him for 4 hours. So they would just play together and play 8 hours as a duo. So Robert Moore, who had Robert's Western World, the club down there, starts kind of putting together a band for them. And so I'm seeing this band kind of come to be. And some nights they had a great drummer and it was great. Some nights they had a terrible drummer and it was awful. It depended on the drummer. A band is only as good as their drummer, right? That drummer from Kansas that Chuck had left with to go on the road, Chuck encouraged him to move to Nashville. So he came here. And when he got here, all of a sudden it was like, oh, that's BR549. They're a real thing. And they're musically great. And it was really fun. And they started bringing in this diverse crowd. It was you couldn't say what type of person it was. It was just lower Broadway. It was just its own animal. So I'm just going down there. I'm still playing in Hellbilly. I'm going down there to hang out on nights that weren't in town to see them and enjoy lower Broad. And I'm watching them. They had an electric bass player. Again, I'm a guitar player, but I'm watching them saying, man, they need an upright bass player. So I approach them one night and say, you guys really need an upright bass player. I'm hearing the songs you're doing are calling for an upright bass. And they said, yeah, we're thinking the same thing. Do you know anybody? And again, I'm a guitar player. I wasn't an upright bass player. So the guys that I knew in town were only a couple guys, but I tried to like put them in touch with these guys. And to a man, they kept talking to these upright bass players who were like, why would I want to come down and play on lower Broadway? They were looking at it like I had looked at it 6 months before. Like, yeah, that's a nowhere gig, you know. Like, oh, I've got real gigs. There was Johnny Cash's bass player, Emmylou Harris's bass player. And they did have real gigs. They weren't going to waste their time with this band playing for tips. So when they kind of struck out on that front, they got a gig opening for Nick Lowe at 328 Performance Hall. So again, I'm hanging out with them. I'm backstage with them. Chuck and Shaw, the drummer, pulled me out backstage and out the back door. And they said, what about you getting an upright bass and joining our band? And I think I just had enough alcohol that night to say, yeah, I'll do that. You know, if I was sober, I don't know if I would have jumped in. But yeah, and the ramifications was...
Hooray, whiskey.
Right. The ramifications was I'm in a band, a working band, Hellbilly, that we have gigs planned. And it was not easy, but there was so much upside that I jumped at the chance. And I bought a bass, and I joined the band and started cramming. Now, I knew music theory. I knew their material. It was just a new animal to play an upright bass. But the upside of it was I'm listening to my same old records I've grown up listening to, but I never had listened to the bass player. I never thought about what the bass was doing. I was listening to the guitar player. So I was rediscovering my record collection.
Oh, how cool.
Which was, yeah, it was so great to hear Buddy Holly records again, Bill Haley records, Little Richard records, Johnny Cash records. And I never had really thought about what the bass player was doing. So that was really exciting. And so I'm jumping in, I'm playing for tips, playing every night. Opposite approach from Hellbilly, where we were trying to travel around and build a network. This was a thing where we're going to take over this stage and we're going to play. We're here every night, all night. We don't take a break. It's just, you know, we're here. And Gary Talent plays bass with Bruce Springsteen, had recently moved to Nashville, and he was in there, and he's a music lover and loves old music and knows where we're coming from. And he came up and he gave us a tip, and he just said to me, he said, you guys, nobody else gets it in this town. You guys are doing, you take over a bandstand, you play every night. That's how you do it. You get good. And he walks out the door, he leaves Roberts, and I'm standing there, and it hits me as it all washes over me that, oh, that's what they did in Jersey. Like, whether you like Bruce Springsteen or not, the history of that speaks. And that was the biggest tip. It wasn't the money he dropped in the jar. It was kind of sharing that wisdom of like, this is what you do. And that was our training because we played every night, long sets, and were thrown curveballs musically and tried different songs and fell on our face, and the crowd was a part of it, and they watched us fail, and they watched us take on a song that, you know, was not the norm, and sometimes with great results and sometimes with horrible results, but that was part of it, and that prepared us to go on the road and play in different settings and be able to roll with the punches. And playing in Lower Broadway every night, a long set, it was our preparation to go take on the world.
Yeah.
And we did.
1 foot, 2 foot, green foot, slew foot.
Crowds keep getting bigger.
Crowds kept getting bigger. It's not a big, it's similar size to Lucy's. It's not a big room, but you know, packed people in there. And as the crowds got bigger, especially in the summertime, you had tourists, and it started to become the place to go. And the Mavericks were really happening at that time. And they were coming down. When they were in town, they would come hang out. And there was a drunk man approached the stage. Now, I drink. We've established that already. But this drunk man came up, and I kind of blew him off because, I don't have time to talk to you right now. And I was kind of didn't want to engage with him. Well, Paul Deacon, the drummer for the Mavericks, walks up behind this man and gets my attention. And he kind of motioned to me, and he kind of mouthed the words. He said, "Talk to this guy."
Oh.
And so I talked to him, and his name was Timothy White, and he was the editor of Billboard magazine from New York City. He said, "This is an amazing thing going on here, and the world needs to know about it. I'm going to do a feature story in Billboard magazine." I'm talking to him the whole time thinking, tomorrow morning, this guy's going to wake up and not remember this. And I didn't take it seriously because I didn't have much faith in it. Well, the next, I think that was a Saturday night, Monday morning, Jim Bestman was assigned to do a story for Billboard, and we were called to do an interview in Music Row at the Billboard office, and we went down there and talked about it. And so they did a big feature. It was about us and Greg Gehring and Paul Birch and Tim Carroll and everything that was happening on Broadway and how it was the next big thing. And again, I'm thinking, well, that's some nice press. That's great. That's national press. I've never gotten that before. That's wonderful. But I didn't see it further than that. Well, the following weekend, all these record people started flying in to see what was going on Lower Broadway because of this article. So we're being taken out to eat and meeting people from Geffen Records and MCA and all these labels. Rounder Records flew in from Boston, and all these people are wining and dining us. And again, we don't know what to make of it, but I just remember being offered everything under, it was slimy record business things going on.
Anything that you want to talk about now?
Well, it was very slimy. It just felt, it felt dirty. Okay. It just felt dirty. People were like, I remember one guy was like, "What do you like?" And I was like, "What do you mean, what do I like?" And he's like, "What's your vice? What do you like?"
Oh, jeez.
You know, it was kind of like he was saying, "Do you like men? Do you like women? Do you like, you know?" Yeah. And I was like, "I like records." And he was like, "Okay, I can get you records." You know, and it just felt dirty. It felt so dirty. So, but again, it was superficial. It was this thing of this, all these people had read this article and they all came in, and it was nice to be a center of attention, but it felt fleeting, like this could all go away instantly, as quickly as it came. Well, the fact that all those record label people came in from out of town got the attention of the local labels. They knew what we were doing down there, but they never saw it as a viable, sellable thing. So they, I think, had this sense of, well, we can't let this band get signed from under our noses. Like, that's not going to look good on us. Like, if Geffen comes in and gives them a record deal, then, you know. So that next weekend was all the Nashville labels. And then they're taking us out to eat and wining and dining us. And it was great. But it was a head-swimming, overwhelming thing. Like, I don't know who to trust, and everybody's coming at you with just, again, it felt dirty, and it was weird. I remember having a dream during that whole process where I could call home to Indiana and talk to my parents, and they were people that it was kind of an escape for me. I could talk to some sane, it wasn't crazy. Well, I had this dream where I was on the phone with my mom, and we were talking, and it was just like relaxing, like just talking to mom and dad. Everything's fine. And my mom, in the dream, my mom was like, you really should go with RCA. And I woke up kind of like, ah! And I realized, like, it's coming. It's taking me over. I'm in this world of this crazy record business thing. So we ended up signing with Arista Records. We did a live record, Live from Roberts, and that was our first release. And the irony of that was, to promote the Live from Roberts record, we had to leave and travel. So we leave Roberts, and I'm thinking in the moment, this is where it can all go to hell. It can all splinter right here. You're taking this entity and putting it on the road. You have all these pitfalls and things that are distractions, you know. So the very first thing that we did was we opened two nights for Vince Gill in hockey arenas, I think Huntsville and Macon, Georgia. So we go and we play, and it's this impersonal, completely different thing. And our approach was, we're going to take that same thing that works at Roberts, and we're going to do it in this setting. And Darren Murphy was looking at booking us as a booking agent. And so he set up those shows for us to open and put us in that place. And he went to the shows and watched, walked around. And I remember him running after the first night, he ran up to us backstage. He said, it totally works. It totally works. You guys do what you do. It translates. I felt like I was at Roberts. And standing on stage, we didn't feel like we were at Roberts, but we understood what he was saying. You know, you're taking down that barrier between you and the audience. The same way, we didn't have a rehearsed show. It was, you know, if we fall flat on our face, the crowd is right there with us, and they see it all, and we do what we do. We didn't have a set list ever. We always had a tip jar. That was part of the shtick. We got to play, and I got to meet my heroes, and it was so amazing. I couldn't even have dreamed it better than it happened.
Which hero made the most impact?
Well, John Fogerty was wanting us to open a tour. He had not toured in a long time, and he was doing the Blue Moon Swamp album and touring on it, and he wanted us to open. And I remember thinking, like, man, John Fogerty to me is not a real person. He's this force in my record collection that it was weird to meet these people and realize, like, oh, they listen to music like I do. Like, he pulls out a record and puts it on the turntable or puts a CD in his car. And I don't think of them as real people. So at this moment, we had done several tours in a row, and we were burned. And these just...
Burned out.
Yeah. Burned out. Like, we did a full Bob Dylan tour and then Brian Setzer Orchestra. And it's like, we kept getting these offers that were too good to turn down. We got to do that. Okay, well, we need a break. We need 2 weeks off. But we got to do this tour. Oh, this person, you know. So we're at this point where we had said four times, okay, we'll do this one thing, and then we'll take a break. Okay, we'll do this one thing. Okay, we'll do this one thing. And then the fourth one was, well, John Fogerty wants you to do the whole tour. And we was like, we can't do it. And his people were like, no, wait, we said John Fogerty wants you to open his summer tour. Yeah, we heard we can't, you know, we're going to kill each other if we do that. Yeah. So we agreed to do the two nights at the Ryman and didn't do the tour. So when we did the shows with him, I met him backstage before we played, and I'm standing there talking to John Fogerty, and I couldn't pay attention to what he was saying because it was that voice. It was that voice that we've all heard our whole lives. He would say something, and then I'd realize, oh, he just asked me a question. What? And I, you know, starstruck, and I'm just like, whoa, wow.
The actual literal starstruck.
I was. Yeah, I was wow. Starstruck. I was standing there thinking, oh, my God, this is a real person. And and then the idea that he, you know, he's like, I really like your record. You know, my wife is sick of hearing it, you know, and I'm like, well, that's the sweetest thing I've ever heard. But so that was an amazing thing. But that it all goes back to that, to realize that these icons and these people that I don't even think of as real people are real people, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That Bob Dylan is still listening to music and still discovering and still turning things on.
What was it like to tour with him?
Well, that was, I guess, to me, it gave me a glimpse into that level of fame, in the sense that every person that you come in contact with wants to get to Bob Dylan. Mm, mm. Everybody's got a painting they painted, and he needs to have it. I have a story they want to share with him, and they want a piece of his time. And I was inundated by that, just being the bass player in the opening band.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what he faces every day. Yeah. And I still get emails from people saying, hey, can you get this to Bob Dylan? You know, or we're doing this fundraiser thing, and we want Bob Dylan to be a part of it. And I was like, no, I can't. I don't, you know, there's such a level of.
That description is so vivid, and it makes you realize why people have teams of people. People mm-hmm. like that have teams of people around them that almost become sort of this wall, this fortress.
Right.
Right. Like, you're not getting to Bob Dylan.
Yeah. I understand that side of it, but that was a glimpse into that it was constantly that. And this was, you know, 50 years after he had made his big splash, and he was still that.
Yeah.
So that was really telling. Yeah, we worked with Keith Richards. That was similar. Again, layers of security and...
When you say you worked with him, did you record with him?
We did. So Timothy White, who was the Billboard guy, would put on these fundraisers, and he would call and say, hey, I need a favor. We're like, yes, we will do it. And it was a Rainforest Alliance gig. It was Keith Richards was the big headliner. With the solo band. They said, we're doing 3 days of rehearsal in New York City for this show. Do you want to do that? Now, in the past, we would never do rehearsal days because we were playing gigs every day. We didn't look at it like, oh, we got to rehearse. So we always turned that down. So this gig comes up. It's 3 days of rehearsal in New York City with Keith Richards. We're like, yes, we will do that. So we go to SIR in New York City, and they had, so it was the Expensive Winos, Keith's band, and they were rehearsing the song Happy, and there were couches set up, and I remember I just had gin and tonics sitting in a couch about as far as I am away from you, Keith Richards is playing Happy, and they did it, they deconstructed the song, they did it in every style, they played it reggae, they played it ska, they played it a waltz, they played it every, you know, country, they did, again, with different degrees of success, but they were just breaking down the song. And I'm like, I can't wait to hear how are they really going to do it when the show comes up. And when the show happened, they did it just like the record, just like you've heard it growing up. But while I was sitting there at the rehearsals and just taking it in, it was just like, wow, you know, I'm hanging out with Keith Richards. And he was a music fan. He wanted to talk to Donnie, our steel player, about his tunings. He wanted to talk about our instruments. He wanted to talk. It was very lucid and focused. And then somebody from the press would walk in the room, and he would kind of go into that Keith Richards character.
Interesting.
You know, all of a sudden it would be the like you make fun of. But I realized that was a defense. That was kind of a barrier that he put up. Then that person would leave the room, and he'd come back and he'd be like, so the fourth string is a, you know, like it was very,
yeah.
It was a very much a put on a defense. I also noticed, I'm sure, you know, I'm around this person for 3 days. I, you know, tiny little glimpse, but I noticed that he would be drinking apple juice, but in like a whiskey glass. And so other people around us would be like, it was 10:30 in the morning and he was drinking, you know, like, well, I don't know what he was drinking, but I saw him only drink apple juice. You know. But again, that level of scrutiny and fame is bizarre to be around, especially when you're coming from just playing little back of a record store in Nashville, Tennessee.
Do you ever go to downtown now? Do you ever go to Lower Broad now?
Mm-hmm. It's the best. I fight the parking and the people, and it's a zoo and it's mayhem. And it's this right now is exactly what I wished it was when I showed up. I wanted it to be crazy. Yes, it's a pain in the butt. Yes, it's loud and, you know, bachelorette parties. And yeah, of course, there's the negative. But when I went down there in 1992, it was so empty and dead and sad that I was like, this place should be buzzing. There should be bands everywhere you turn. There should be this going on. So I am super excited that it's thriving and crazy. I took a friend from out of town down there, and as we approached, you hear music from every direction, and it's overwhelming. And he said, wow, this is like heaven. Mm. And we walked a few more feet, and he said, maybe this is hell. And it's like, well, there's truth in both sides of that. It is. It's cacophony. It's a mess. It's a glorious mess.
Thank you so much for listening. This show is brought to you by Give 40 the Finger Productions and We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can check out all their podcasts at the official site at weownthistown.net or follow at We Own This Town on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you want more info about the Lucy's episodes, you can visit the show notes or go to lucysrecordshop.com. You can also follow at Lucy's Record Shop on Twitter or Instagram and join the Lucy's community over on Facebook. Many thanks to Michael Eads for his time and the use of his studio. And thank you for listening and for all the positive feedback, as well as all the pictures and memories you've shared. You're the best.